Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, my guest is Chris Swank. Chris is at Signum University. She has published variously on Game of Thrones. And she explains two things that I was really curious about, that being peace weaving and the Blood Eagle ritual. Steve and I cover Blood of My Blood. And then in my Bird's Eye View section, I include an excerpt of my conversation with Jason Kabasi from the Podcastica Network. You might have listened to his Game of Thrones podcast back in the day. But anyway, Jason and I do a retrospective on Game of Thrones in this week's episode of Cocoons of Horror. So you can search for Cocoons of Horror wherever you search for podcasts. And if you do this week, you will hear the full hour-long conversation between Jason and I where we do that retrospective and also anticipate a bit of House of the Dragon. I'll include just a short excerpt of that conversation in my Bird's Eye View section. And if you're wondering, yes, this is my clever way to get you over to Cocoons of Horror. It's a ton of fun. You can listen. You can follow. You could write us a review on Apple iTunes. Consider it my early birthday gift / Christmas gift / winter solstice. No. It's the St. Paddy's gift. That's what we'll call it. The St. Paddy's Day gift. I would really appreciate your help. Without further ado, here is Dr. Chris Swank. Chris Swank, today we are covering Catelyn. This is her 8th chapter. And I found you because I was looking at the table of contents of a book.
Oh, which book?
Again, Salvation by Book. Queenship and the Women of Westeros. So you wrote an essay in there. And what was the essay title of that one?
The Peace Weavers of Winterfell.
The Peace Weavers of Winterfell. So I thought maybe we could start by talking a little bit about what does it mean to be a peace weaver? And is this always a gendered category? And just tell me everything I need to know about peace weaving.
Sure. It's an Anglo-Saxon concept. We meet it in Beowulf, as well as in some of the other literature like Maxims 1. And it seems to be that a peace weaver would be a woman who tried to bring two tribes together through marriage and establish the peace. But in Beowulf, this doesn't last very long. It doesn't seem to be a super effective way to bring peace to the previously warring parties, but they try it anyway. And that seems to be a function of the highborn women. There's a lot of evidence that Martin was thinking of the Anglo-Saxon culture when he was writing the Starks.
Right.
And so the women of the Stark family have been peace weavers. So they just, if you marry your enemy and you have a child with that enemy, then that child kind of binds the two sides together, and you wouldn't want to necessarily attack that castle because your blood is now in that castle.
Yeah, it's sort of like the intermingling of blood. You could call it blood weaving.
Yes.
Sort of a substratum of the peace weaving, right?
Yes. And then, but more than just being the bride and the mother, the peace weaver was also an intelligent woman. She would give her husband counsel on, I guess, internal matters to do with, you know, the running of the castle, but she also might give him political counsel. And you see this with Catelyn.
Yeah.
Absolutely giving Ned Stark advice and welcome advice, not interfering, shrewish advice, but he turns to her as his greatest counselor.
And in the chapter we're looking at today, she becomes Rob's counselor.
Exactly.
All right. I'm going to read a short synopsis of this chapter, and then we can talk about it. Kat arrives at the ruins of Moat Cailin with the rotund Manderly brothers. Manderly brothers almost sounds like a 1950s doo-wop group or something.
I think I had their album.
Yeah. I like their newer stuff myself. She rides to the gatehouse tower and discovers that Rob is preparing for war with several of Ned's bannermen. After pleasantries, introductions, and news from the Eyrie, Kat asks to speak with Rob alone. She tests her son's resolve. They discuss Sansa, Arya, Cersei, Kat questions him about his leadership and wartime strategy. Rob reveals his plan to divide his host and force a river between Jaime and Tywin's armies. He will lead the mounted men against Jaime. He wants to send the Great John against Tywin, but then thinks better of it upon Kat's advice. Rather than the Great John, he will give Roose Bolton the lead. Then Rob tries to send Kat to Winterfell, but she declines. She will go see her dying father and beleaguered brother at River Run. So, Chris Swank, would you like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the Ladder of Chaos?
I think the Ladder of Chaos sounds fascinating. However, I'd really like to talk about Kat.
Ladder of Chaos is perilous. So tell me about Kat.
As the shadowling of Winterfell at the beginning of the series, she is really a great example of the Anglo-Saxon peace weaver. She has to negotiate between the king and the queen showing up, between Jon Snow, you know, being really one of the family, but she doesn't want him to have children that would rival her children's children. And so really encourages the whole idea of going to the wall for Jon. Mm-hmm. And then when Robert asks Ned to be the hand, in the books, she's like, yes, you have to do this. If you, you know, say yeah. no, he's going to suspect you're against him. And she convinces him. In the TV show, they really undercut the character.
I agree with you. Oh my gosh, I couldn't stand that part of it.
She's like, don't go. And he's like, oh, I have to go. But really, in the book, she's behaving.
Kicking him out the door.
Yeah. Well, so Ned leaves her in charge of Winterfell, right? Uh-huh. And says, counsel our son. And he goes to off to be the hand. She almost immediately leaves Winterfell and never goes back. She's running all over Westeros. Mm-hmm. And this is not the function of a peace weaver. It sounds very regressive in a feminist way, but if we're to read the Starks as Anglo-Saxons, she should not have been running around Westeros. She should have stayed in Winterfell. Think of all the things that could have been prevented if she'd stayed in Winterfell. But instead, she's down here now at Moat Cailin. She's giving Rob military advice.
Yeah.
Probably helping to undercut some authority that he's got with people like the Boltons. We see how that turns out. She's told to go home and she's like, nope, I'm going to go see my dad, my brother. And that's not her function, really. She should be the shadowing of Winterfell at this point. So I think this is a really interesting chapter where she could make things right and go home, protect the keep from, just Bran is back there, really. She sent, I think, Sir Roderick back there.
She did, yeah. He needed to be there.
Yeah,
he's commanded to do what Ned commanded her to do, right?
Right. So this is really a turning point. There are so many turning points in the story where character could do the right thing or do the wrong thing. And of course, Martin's interesting because they always do the wrong thing. And here she really should have gone home instead of going to River Run.
There's a lot of interesting plot that can happen when characters do the wrong thing.
Indeed. That's why we keep reading this.
That's right. I mean, I think that part of investing in a character like Kat, regardless of her gender, is that she's not always going to do the right thing. Like, a character who always does the right thing is just uninteresting, right?
Right. They all stayed at Winterfell and lived happily ever after. Would have been a much shorter series.
Right. So I wonder if... I mean, it's interesting that, there's almost like this pattern in Martin's work about, women who fail to be peace weavers, or maybe they're tragically inefficient peace weavers. So I want to absolutely echo the thesis of your paper. At the same time, I wonder if some of this is just the virtue of the plot. The plot's more interesting if one of these compelling characters makes the wrong decision for seemingly the right reason or something along those lines.
Sure. Yes, it all makes sense. And the military advice that she's giving Rob makes sense in several chapters from now, you know, with joining Renly Baratheon or trying to negotiate for Sansa and Arya's release. But honestly, if she had just stayed in Winterfell, this sounds terribly unfeminist of me, but from the terms of the book, if she had just stayed in Winterfell when Ned was taken, she could have calmed Rob down. And maybe they wouldn't have sent for the banners and declared war.
Sure.
Maybe they could have negotiated out of this situation, but she wasn't there.
No, I totally get that. And I think you're absolutely right on this. I think a lot of times what I'll hear from other folks is if she just hadn't misjudged Tyrion, you know, this all could have been avoided, right? Or if she just hadn't been duped by Littlefinger, this all could have been avoided. Well, guess who else is duped by Littlefinger? Almost everyone.
Everybody.
Guess who else misjudges Tyrion? Almost everyone. And I think sometimes this is meant to undercut Kat's political savvy, but that's not how I read her at all. I think that she absolutely has as much savvy as any Southern lord or lady. Maybe she doesn't manage the North nearly as well as someone who is a native to the North might.
Yeah, their strength is in holding the North. And as soon as Winterfell falls to Theon, then that's all.
I want to read this short. Yeah. I want to read this short passage from the chapter.
Yeah.
So Kat is questioning Rob on why he is, you know, as a 15-year-old, has taken leadership. "They are not Starks," he said. "They are men, Rob. Seasoned in battle. You were fighting with wooden swords less than a year past." She saw anger in his eyes at that, but it was gone as quick as it came, and suddenly he was a boy again. "I know," he said, abashed. Are you sending me back to Winterfell?" Kat sighed. "I should. You ought never to have left. Yet I dare not. Not now. You have come too far. Someday these lords will look at you as their liege. If I pack you off now like a child being sent to bed without his supper, they will remember, they will laugh about it in their cups. The day will come when you will need their respect, even to fear you a little. Laughter is poison to fear. I will not do that to you, as much as I might wish to keep you safe." So, man, I reread that passage a number of times for a lot of different reasons, but after reading your essay, I reread it and I thought, I wonder if Chris would think of this as an example of peace weaving between Rob and his future bannerman.
Yes. And I don't even know if she would be able to send him home, so to speak. Like, if he didn't want to go.
Sure. But
mommy
couldn't cowers.
Make him, but yes.
Yeah. Where is the power? Power is where men think it resides, right?
Right.
So if Rob kind of cowers and becomes her son and takes off that cloak of, you know, Lord of Winterfell or whatever, then she might have quite a bit of power over him. I think Kat maybe knows this, but I think ultimately she wants to sow peace between Rob and these bannermen. What do you think about that? Am I thinking about this
and
wrongly?
She doesn't know, and she—that's her only play at this point, right? Mm. He's already called the banners. It's not right. We can't undo that. She sizes up the situation very quickly. She walks into the kind of broken down keep that they're using, the hall with the peat fire, you know, roaring.
Right.
And she immediately sizes up the situation, and she wants to run to her son and hug him.
Yeah.
And she knows, I can't do that in front of these men. That would just make him seem like a little boy. So she has that instinct right away to try to position him as the leader of the armies.
Right.
Even though he's 15 years old.
Well, I was rereading the passage where what Ned tells her before she leaves King's Landing. He says, go, you know, send word to the Great John Umber and send word to Hellman Tallheart and tell them to fortify Moat Caitlin. And so that kind of happens. Like, the both of those guys are there, but it's under Rob's leadership, you know. So, I mean, I guess you could say that What Kat could have done here is she could have said, I have word from Ned Stark, your liege lord. And he said that John Umber and Helmand Tallheart are to take control of this force or something. And of course, I'm going to take the future lord of Winterfell back to Winterfell. I think she could have made that play. I mean, she thinks better of it, but I think that would be an option to her.
I think that might have worked with Tallheart and Great John. It wouldn't have worked with Bolton. Well, I don't know what would have worked with Bolton anyway. But any sign of weakness, you know, wouldn't have worked with.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think she makes a decision that she thinks will put her son in the best position to be the Lord of Winterfell.
Mm-hmm.
And that she also knows, like, well, this could mean death for everyone, but it's really the only way forward. I guess I'm just thinking, you know, she decides for that rather than the other option would be, you know, to keep Rob safe back at Winterfell. That's not insignificant to me.
Yeah, I think that play needed to be made when Ned was taken, when they got word that Ned was taken, to fortify Winterfell. But, you know, she wasn't there to give that advice. I also think it's a bad play for her to leave him at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So the Peace Weaver is a wife first. And then if the husband is dead or gone, then to be the mother of the next lord.
Mm.
Instead, she wants to write off and see her father and her brother. That's no longer her responsibility.
Right. Okay. A second and really important part of your essay was this, I guess, these two other categories that we see in the women of Beowulf. And I wonder if you could talk about, sort of the Strife Weaver and the She-Wolf.
Sure. So the Strife Weaver is not a phrase from Beowulf. It is a category that some feminist scholars have assigned to people like Grendel's mother. And do we do spoilers on this podcast?
Absolutely, we do.
All right. Yeah. So when Kat turns into Lady Stoneheart, you know, she is that sort of Strife Weaver where she's taking her vengeance out on her enemies in the same way that Grendel's mother does.
Uh-huh.
You could call Arya a Strife Weaver. She takes vengeance out on anybody that, you know, she's got her whole litany of people that she says before bed every night,
right,
and wants to take them out. So the Strife Weaver is a woman who enters the male world of battle, which is not an Anglo-Saxon value. That's not what women should be doing. And you often find the Strife Weavers.
Yeah, right. If we take this category seriously, this is almost a monstrous category, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And women who engage in military matters in the Anglo-Saxon literature are considered monsters.
Mm.
So that's one category.
Lady Stoneheart is very much a monster. I mean,
absolutely.
Right. So
absolutely.
So she has that in common with Grendel's mother.
Yes. And Arya becomes something of a monster as well. Then the other category might be my interpolation of a character that's not well looked at in Beowulf, which is she's in a story that they tell within the story of Beowulf. She's Thrith or Modthrith. When she was a princess, all these men tried to court her, and she had them killed. And so they think of her as a monster. Gosh, you just look at that lady and she'll have you killed. She then marries Offa, who is the big king on the block at that time. And she becomes sweet and tender and loving. And the traditional interpretation of that is, Offa controlled her. He got her on a leash and now she's behaving like a woman. But some feminist scholars are looking at her and saying, maybe these courtiers that were approaching her were thought of as sexual harassers or were not welcome.
Yeah, maybe so she has warrant for not liking to be looked at
right
in the way that they're looking at her.
Right. And she is a princess and has the power to have them killed. So that's how she gets rid of them. And they maybe Offa allows her the security that that's not going to happen anymore. And she can relax. Or maybe she truly loves him. I don't know. Mm. But this idea of a woman that can be both things, right? You're not just loving and tender. You're not just a monster. You move with the situation. And that is like a she-wolf that is tender with her cubs, is vicious with anybody who threatens mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the one woman in Beowulf who has a happy ending. There's one woman in the Game of Thrones that seems to have a happy ending after much travail, according to the movies or the TV show, is mm-hmm. Sansa. And Sansa right. uses both the tenderness, and she learns to use the authority to have people killed, as is warranted. So those are some categories that you can see of women in Beowulf
yeah.
that are also reflected in Martin's series.
Right. So let's say I'm looking at Grendel's mother through new eyes because of this category of she-wolf. I'm wondering if maybe we could interpret Grendel's mother as someone who is justifiably protective of her only son and justifiably avenges him.
Correct.
So, yes. I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily how that story is intended to be read, but of course, you know, we readers have a certain autonomy in these things.
You even have some revisions of the Beowulf story coming out to that effect, that she's a wronged mother, or that she's a mother whose child was wrongly killed, has no male relatives to take her vengeance for her, and has to do it herself. Of course, the male-dominated Danes would think she was a monster because she's not behaving in a ladylike manner. When Catelyn becomes involved with the military decisions and Rob's troop movements, as she begins to in this chapter, she also goes down that road to being monstrous in the eyes of the male-dominated Westeros.
Right. And of course, I'm interested here in, since we're already talking about Lady Stoneheart, I think that eventually Kat's decision not to go back to Winterfell has consequences too, because she's the one that really arranges for the crossing at the twins.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that she does that is that she arranges a few marriages. One of the marriages is, you know, between one of Frey's daughters and Rob. And then, of course, that sets up a tremendous consequence for Rob eventually, and for Kat.
Yeah. And back to your question earlier about, is the Peaceweaver category always female? Well, in the Anglo-Saxon literature, yes. But in Martin, not necessarily. Because when the marriage between Rob and the Frey girl doesn't come off, Kat negotiates for her brother.
Right. Edmure, yeah, Edmure becomes the
A Frey. Right. He becomes a hostage to the Freys, and he's that tragic failed peaceweaver.
Right, of course.
His marriage doesn't settle the peace. There's actually violence at his wedding. It doesn't settle the peace for a single minute.
He wasn't a good enough prize, I suppose.
Right.
They wanted Rob. They didn't want the poor substitution, the poor Echo. I was fascinated by this other mention that you just make in passing in the essay. And that is to the Blood Eagle ritual. Because in this chapter, we meet for the first time Roose Bolton.
Right.
And we've heard about Roose before, but this is the first time we really meet him. And the way that he's introduced is a formidable person, but he's really kind of scary. So tell me a little bit about maybe the Roose Bolton connection to Viking lore.
Sure. I think even Rob says he kind of scares me.
No doubt.
The historicity of the Blood Eagle ritual, notwithstanding, it's a popular enough trope that it's useful here as a reference.
Oh, absolutely. Because Martin loves the rumors of history as much as anything else.
Right? Of course, we all do. Come on. Yeah. So the sign of the sigil of the Bolton family is the flayed man. This is what they're known to do to their enemies, to flay the skin from them. They're masters at it, and it's on their banner.
Right.
So immediately he's associated with this idea of not just killing your enemy, but really peeling their skin off before they die, mm-hmm. which is gruesome and painful and prolongs that interaction between victor and victim. It's a brilliant move on Martin's behalf to just be able to say on the banner is the flayed man, and immediately people's minds start to run in these directions of this supposed Viking ritual where they open the chest, they pull out the organs and lay them on top of your open chest so that you can see your innards before mm-hmm. you die. I'm going to be passed out a long time before that happens.
Sure.
They pull out your lungs, right? They spread you like a spread eagle and open you up. And so if you've heard these stories, if you know this popular culture idea of Viking treatment of enemies, mm-hmm. then the flayed man on the banner immediately makes you think of that gruesome ritual. And therefore you understand the Boltons that quickly.
Right.
Like a nice family isn't going to have that on their banners.
Right. Okay. So I did a teeny bit of research on this once I read it in your essay.
Oh, good.
So I don't know if this is really kind of half-ass internet research. However, it looks like in Norse tradition, there's two examples of this in Norse literature where this ritual occurs. And in both cases, it's a consequence for a lord or king who has committed patricide. So there's two examples of this, and both of these noblemen killed their own father. I thought it was interesting to me because, while it's not in the books, in the show, Ramsay Bolton ends up killing his own father. And I wonder if there's a connection there. I mean, this is just kind of me surmising.
It certainly could be the way Martin's mind was working, thinking down the road of what's going to happen to these characters. I think that's brilliant.
Well, I'm waiting to see. We don't really know what's going to happen to Ramsay in the books, but I wonder if there will be some flaying consequence to sort of.
Well, someday when Brandon Sanderson finishes the books for us,
okay,
we'll find out.
I always say it'll be the AI construct of George Martin who finishes these books. And I can't wait. I mean, I'm willing to undergo sort of the AI overlords if indeed one of them is a Martin author. Notable introductions in this chapter. So we hear of Wyman Manderley and his fat sausage fingers. Both of his sons, Willis and Wendell. There's a few lords that we've heard about previously, but we sort of meet in person for the first time. We meet the Towers of Moat Cailin, and this is the first mention of the myth about the Hammer of the Waters, which is all very vague, but I guess it's something that some sort of magic that the Children of the Forest were able to do. To kind of create the stepstones between Essos and Westeros. And this is the first mention of ghost skin, which is a ropey, slimy moss that's kind of grossly hanging from certain trees in the bogs of Moat Cailin. And then notable show differences. In the show, the Blackfish is not involved with any of this, which is kind of a shame. I really love that character. I would love to see him in more scenes, but basically, the Blackfish was never at the Eyrie, so Catelyn never really has that exchange with him, and he never decides to travel with Cat. he's kind of like holding down the fort at River Run, basically, in the shows. Did you notice any book versus show differences in this chapter?
Well, I mean, we're talking about Ned's great friend and ally in Moat Cailin, the Crannog Man. Gosh, what is his name again?
Oh, yeah. Reed, Howland Reed.
Howland, right? Reed, yes, that's who I'm thinking of. Who is a really compelling character, right, for in the books, and he doesn't get much press in the TV show until his kids show up, and then we never really meet him in the show, do we, in the TV show?
We never do. We meet his kids. I mean, here's the thing. I think that there is a green scene flashback where you get to see Howland Reed at the Tower of Joy.
Right.
But as far as sort of him showing up to do any, you know, have any kind of impact on the plot later on, it just doesn't happen, which, yeah, anyway.
I think he's a fascinating character. I think this idea that the Crannog men are maybe more indigenous than right? They seem to be more like Tolkien's Woodwoses or something that,
yeah, or at least closer to they're closer to nature in a way, yes, that the Children of the Forest were closer to nature, right?
Yes,
so they, exactly, occupy that kind of liminal space.
And the idea that the towers are falling and there's really not a lot of man-made structure left at Moat Cailin, but the Crannog men can still hold the neck, seems to be maybe by the power of what they understand about nature, or how they can move through the wetlands in ways that more civilized people can't. I just find him a very fascinating character that I'd like to know more about.
Yeah. You and a lot of folks, for sure. Hey, let me ask you this. I really haven't looked into this, but maybe you would know. In the show, Kat does this, she weaves this, I forget what she calls it, but she's actually like creating this piece of like woven artwork as a way to channel her grief for what has happened to Bran, what has happened to Ned. And I don't remember that in the book. Do you know what I'm talking about, or does that ring any bells for you?
I know what you're talking about in the show. I can't think of it in the book.
May I help you, Lady Stark?
No.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't.
You can't help, because a mother makes one for her children to protect them. Only a mother can make them.
You've made them before?
Twice.
Did they work?
After a fashion. I prayed for my son, Bran, to survive his fall. Many years before that, one of the boys came down with the pox. Mr. Lewin said if he made it through the night, he'd live. But it would be a very long night. So I sat with him all through the darkness. Listened to his rugged little breath. Coughing, is whimpering.
Which boy?
Jon Snow. When my husband brought that baby home from the war, I couldn't bear to look at him. Didn't want to see those brown stranger's eyes staring up at me. So I prayed to the gods. Take him away. Make him die. He got the pox. And I knew I was the worst woman who ever lived. A murderer. I'd condemned this poor, innocent child to a horrible death. All because I was jealous of his mother. A woman he didn't even know. So I prayed to all seven gods. Let the boy live. Let him live. And I love him. I'll be a mother to him. I'll beg my husband to give him a true name. To call him Stark and be done with it. To make him one of us.
And he lived.
And he lived. And I couldn't keep my promise. And everything that's happened since then. All this horror that's come to my family. It's all because I couldn't love a motherless child.
And I wonder if that's something. I mean, it's a literal weaving project, and
right.
It made me wonder, like, I wonder if there's something happening here that sort of playing with the metaphor.
Oh, of the peace weaver. See, you're not just a pretty face. That was really good.
Some would say I'm not a pretty face at all. But those people would be dead wrong, Chris.
Yes, there you go.
Anyway, I
that's really clever.
It struck me as interesting in the show, and I don't remember it from the book. So if you're listening to this and you think, no, don't be an idiot, Anthony, that's absolutely in the books. You could find it in chapter whatever.
Yeah.
It's book@baldmove.com. You can set me straight.
Let us know.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover Blood of My Blood. This episode features the merging of Ben Jen and Cold Hands. We have more of the High Sparrow, Tommen, and Marjorie plot. Sam Gilly and Little Sam arrive at Horn Hill. And then Danny finally figures out the Drogon plus Dothraki solution to all of her problems. Well, almost all of them. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, I'm going to give you three possible fathers, and you have to choose one to start a sitcom.
Oh, okay.
So this is going to kind of be like a father knows best premise, but it's going to revolve around one of these three characters that we met in this episode.
Okay.
Walder Frey.
Mm-hmm.
Mace Tyrell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a fun one.
And Randall Tarley. Mm-hmm. Randall is obviously Sam's father.
I would say probably the least problematic. If it's a sitcom, I would take Tyrell, just because I figured there'd be a lot of episodes of him like falling downstairs and saying things like "Who put those there?" and then the audience laughs.
How he is still alive in Game of Thrones is beyond me. I mean, that guy should have been killed like 14 different times.
He's just ultimately just surprised by joy, like all the time. I mean,
you definitely want that guy at your poker game.
He probably brings the greatest dip.
He's going to laugh at all of your Kenny Rogers jokes.
Oh, man.
Every time. Yeah.
And he's going to do one himself, and everyone's like, all right, okay. And then he does like another Kenny Rogers joke. Then you just reach over, hey, Mace, you got to know when to fold them on them jokes. And then everybody now is back on your side.
Oh, and he's going to laugh at every joke about himself.
You just did a Kenny Rogers joke, making fun of too many Kenny Rogers jokes. Yeah.
And at the end of the night, all of his money will be your money.
You know, all of his money is gone, and again, the dip. He talks about the dip, and everybody like kind of makes fun of him for like shut up about the dip. But deep down, everybody's like, man, that dip's real good.
He's the kind of guy who's like, he's gonna lose all of his money, and he's just gonna have a big old smile on his face, and he's gonna think, well, that was just the price of admission.
I can't wait to do that again. Yeah, the poker episodes of this show are really funny. The ones where, you know, there's a couple of sweet moments where everyone just figures he's so bumbling, but then he gives like some real pearls of wisdom to like his son, and they're, you know, kind of shockingly simple but still poignant. And but then, like, you know, as he walks off, he trips on the first step. Who put that here? And then everybody laughs again.
I think he's genuinely trying his best.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, it's one of those, like, this is the guy that'll end up on the Iron Throne just by virtue of just walking in there accidentally.
Okay. Steve, if you were to tell me that there was going to be an episode with no Tyrion, no Jon Snow, and no major deaths, I would think, it's probably going to be a subpar episode. But I liked it. I like this solid Game of Thrones episode.
I like this one a lot. And in fact, now that you mention all those absences, I didn't even really notice.
Yeah, that's the feat. I mean, I think that I'm always going to notice if there's no Tyrion. But then when I looked it up to make sure that it was no Tyrion this episode, I also realized there's no Jon Snow.
Yeah.
And apparently, according to the wiki, it's only the second episode of the series where there wasn't a death.
Really?
Yeah. Although there was a rabbit decapitated, so dismemberment count. And okay. Then Bran drinks the rabbit blood?
Yeah. Yeah, very Lost Boys.
I'm glad that you said that. Because there is a little bit of an homage in this episode, and... Do you remember Ben Jen?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those. Yeah, I guess I do. It does feel a little bit like this guy could have been anybody and everybody I'd already seen in terms of facial recognition software on this one. Like, there's a lot of Game of Thrones characters that can open the same phone.
Sure. Now, in the first book, there's this common refrain, like whenever Jon Snow is thinking, he's like constantly wondering about what happened to his uncle Benjen. And because.
Yeah, and it seems like all of a sudden now there has been an emphasis on Benjen, right? I mean, all the way to the Jon Snow killing, right?
I suppose so. What are you thinking of? I don't remember.
Was that what it was when they mentioned that word of your uncle?
Yeah. That's
and right. That's what they get. That's how they get him out of there or whatever.
That's
and
right.
And then it felt like all of a sudden I'm hearing Benjen's name a lot. It feels like people who, you know, it feels like the showrunner's like, man, we totally forgot to. I thought you were going to mention him 3 episodes ago.
So in the book so far, there's been no resolution at all about Benjen. But there is this character that they call Cold Hands, and he's supposed to be like some undead good guy. And he rides like a giant elk.
All right.
And he saves Sam at one point, and then he saves Bran. And they don't know his name, but he's like as cold as a corpse, and so they call him Cold Hands. Mm. And apparently there was a lot of speculation that maybe Cold Hands was Benjen, but Martin basically said, nah, it's not the same guy. So they've merged a couple characters, as they do from time to time in this show.
Got it.
And then what we learn about him, and I don't think it's in the show, but I might as well mention it, is that he brings them to the wall and he can't go past the wall. And he says something like, there's some strong magic in the wall and I can't go past the border.
Mm.
So there's some kind of sense. And the only reason I mention this is because there was a lot of fan talk about whether the White Walker, the Night King, could actually go beyond the wall.
Oh, okay.
So if the wall's like magic and keeps, you know, the cold side cold.
Right. Yeah. I'm the McDLT of the North.
Exactly. Then how is the Night King going to get across the wall?
And why are we worried that much about him? Just stay on the other side of the wall.
Exactly. So, and then part of the question was, all right, well, the Night King touches Bran. And that allows him to get into the Three-Eyed Raven's abode.
Sure.
So maybe Bran goes south of the wall.
And then now he's a conduit.
Yeah, something like that.
So again, going with the Lost Boys theme, the vampire can't cross the threshold until you invite him.
Exactly.
This is a shot-for-shot remake of Schumacher's okay. Lost Boys.
I don't know if you were ever... did you ever read any of the Dune sci-fis?
No.
All right, well, there's this figurehead in Dune who, when they take on their particular role, they sort of upload the memories of everyone who's ever had the role. So it's just like this matronly figure. And so she doesn't just have her own personality. She kind of carries with her the memories of every character that came before her. The showrunners confirmed that that's supposed to be what's happening to Bran. Like when he has all of his sort of visions and he's flashing through past, present, future events, that he's actually, the Three-Eyed Raven has uploaded all of these centuries of memories into Bran's head.
Okay.
And although the show doesn't do a great job of explaining it, I think what we're supposed to understand is this isn't really Bran Stark anymore. It's Bran Stark plus like the Three-Eyed Raven. So he's like a dual personality.
But doesn't Benjen suggest that he needs to become the Three-Eyed Raven? Like he has a choice, or is that, am I missing it?
Well,
or is he just saying this is what you're becoming and you need to become this?
I think what Benjen says is that he says the Three-Eyed Raven summoned me, and then Mira says he's dead. And then when Bran wakes up, Benjen said, and lives again.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think I was wrong to say dual personality. I think he's more like a collective personality. So Bran Stark, as we knew him, is gone, basically. He's just part of this collective Three-Eyed Raven personality.
Mm.
And to be honest, I really wish the show did more to explain that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get, like, I just, it kind of comes off a little bit more like maybe a degree of possession, which I guess is kind of close.
I suppose so. And we have seen that with Hodor, right? Because Bran possesses Hodor, but it's not really Hodor. Hodor is like not really present at that point.
Right. So that's where it's like, okay, well, Bran seems to be sort of towing the line between being present and also being everywhere, or at least where his memories take him, I guess.
All right. So I want to talk about Arya. She decides not to kill the actress that she's supposed to kill.
Arya is just not ready to be someone other than Arya.
I think Arya has figured out that she's Arya. I think there was a while there where she was like, I need to find some kind of meaning in my life. And I think that if I follow sort of the footsteps of Cyril Pharrell, go to Braavos, or follow like the Jack and Hagar faceless man thing, there's some power there. And I need power. Right. Because I'm basically powerless and I got shit to do. Right.
Right.
But I think what she realizes, I think what ends up happening is she's a little bit tempted by the actress. Like she thinks, oh, I could actually be pretty good at this. I join this acting troupe and, you know, someone that believes that I'm worth something. And then she realizes, nah, that's not me. And then I think she realizes, well, maybe the faceless man isn't me either. Maybe, right. Maybe I'm me. And then, of course, you know, if you needed to be hit over the head with a metaphor, she goes and gets a needle.
Right.
So she gets her identity back in that way. And supposedly.
Now she's marked for death.
Now she's marked for death. And I'm just curious. Have you ever cared to find out the name of this other faceless man girl that wants to kill Arya?
Well, I mean, I think you can't, right? I mean, it's sort of a product of this plot line, right? I mean, if we get her backstory, she wouldn't be an apt pupil for the faceless man, right? I mean, because we don't know anything. She just exists and she feels, I mean, she definitely just feels more like a plot device than a person.
Yeah, yeah.
So with that, it almost
there's something about her that Arya can look at her and think, well, that's who I could become.
Right. In a way, it's either a goal or a cautionary tale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that probably plays into it. And there definitely seems to be the one thing about her which sort of betrays this nothingness is she appears to be somebody with a bit of an agenda.
Oh, she's either jealous or she just enjoys torturing Arya.
Right. And so either way, there's this element of like, well, we don't know any of her motivations. All we know is that she's there to cause pain and suffering, and she doesn't particularly care for this Arya person, which also suggests like, well, this is not, you know, so that's where I think like it can get kind of frustrating sometimes, because you're like, well, it seems like she's this great student and she's definitely got it all down, but she's clearly not just doing this for the greater good, whatever that is in this
particular. You're right, the fact that she has agenda suggests that she's got some kind of agency, which makes her someone rather than no one.
Right. And then on top of that, it's like, and you know, Jacken seems to be like kind of on top of a lot of this. Why isn't that seem to be something that's kind of recognized? So again, it's like, is this a blind spot? Like, so there's a lot of questions, right? And I'm curious, and I'm hoping to see what ends up happening. Is like, is this all part of it? Like, is it intentional that maybe he's not realizing what's going on, or does he know what's going on and this is part of his grander lesson? It's so hard to know because it's shrouded in so much mystery. But then I get concerned from a narrative perspective, well, is it shrouded in mystery or is it just not fleshed out?
Well, all right, yeah, I think that here's my, and I feel this way about a lot of science fiction too. I feel like if you're going to keep a mystery, if you're going to keep the veils up, you have to reveal just a little bit every episode to keep me wanting to get into the mystery. You have to draw me into it. You can't just totally wall it off until the very end. I need a little bit of the mystery revealed if you're going to keep drawing me into the mystery. One of the reasons that I would not want Randall Tarley as my father. And there are maybe a few reasons I could think up. Did you catch Sam's brother's name?
No.
It's Dickon.
Oh, okay.
Which I do think Bran probably named him at some point.
Right. Yeah, he didn't mean to, but...
And I don't really want to recreate that scene, but...
It has to do with him being very cold and concerned that his penis fell off. He's out there yelling at Mira, "Is my dick on?" She's like, "What?
Is my dick on?" So, yeah, you name any father that names his son Dickon, I just not going to trust the guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big moment. You know, you get to Sam's house, and we've heard all these.
That scene was dynamite. I loved it. Yeah. I loved everything about just the complete fish out of water. And here Sam is sort of the returning hero. He killed the Thin, killed the White Walker. He's become, in so many ways, he's become the man that his father never thought he could be.
Right.
And
it's not like he went out there and all of a sudden just comes back shredded and he's just super brave. But I mean, considering what, you know, that he's able to still maintain his level of intelligence and his kindness, but he also has demonstrated numerous times that he's willing to put his life on the line for others.
Yeah. Yeah, he walks the walk. And in addition to that, I mean, you really see it sort of like he's gotten a lot of his mother's sort of personality. You know, her kindness, her compassion. And yet, even though he's become the man that his father never thought he could be, he totally reverts back to, you know, this brutalized, abused kid.
Yeah.
When he's at his father's table.
Well, and you see that, right? You see that with families. Often.
Oh, yeah.
I even see it with my wife's family. When all the sisters get together, it's like inevitably they start to play their familiar roles.
Yeah, yeah. It's the patterns that you've developed as a child that kind of predetermine how these relationships are going to evolve, right?
And in some ways they almost feel necessary, because if there's any deviation, it sets everything kind of in a very odd motion. Like, well, we don't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm. So that was wonderful, I thought.
And so this is, of course, not in the book, right? We never get to
never go to Hornhill in the book,
which, you know, is pretty remarkable, because it is, you know, a very effective scene. And, you know, you get the sense that, you know, Sam's a guy that we've kind of fallen in love with, and we know his backstory is peppered with a terrible father and that complication. Yeah,
part of what made him interesting as a character in the first place was this story about how his father basically disowned him and threatened to murder him. It's like, this guy must be a real bastard.
Yeah.
But this, and the actor that comes in is like, oh no, this guy's even worse than I thought.
Yeah, right, which is an incredible payoff, and that's why I think the scene works so well, and I think everybody does great in it, even the other brother, you know, Dickon.
You mean Dickon of Hornhill?
Dickon of Hornhill. Like, he doesn't
Hornhill. Dickon is something of an appropriate name,
right? Well, he doesn't you know, he doesn't just like pile on necessarily with Sam either. It's like there is this, it seems to be throughout the entire house, there's a genuine affection for Sam, except for the father.
Yeah.
And so this is like, it seems like this is a dividing moment, and it's just out of pure patriarchal respect that this kind of stuff continues to go on, it seems like. And so when the mother kind of storms off, it's like, you could see that, you know, you don't know a ton about their backstory, but you feel like you get a lot of their characters in just an economy of scenes. And it's a rich moment. And when his eventual fleeing now creates this, like, a new tension. There's already so much tension around the Sam and Gilly and Sam dynamic. And then now you add this, I'm going to take the family sword on top of it.
Yeah, right. I honestly didn't know, when I watched the show, I had no idea what was going to happen, because, of course, it hasn't happened in the books.
So that's got to be kind of a fun experience too. I mean,
yo, absolutely. And so it was sort of like, yeah, no, of course he's going to drop Gilly off because maybe she's done, you know, maybe she's served her purpose,
right,
to sort of explain something about Sam. I mean, it'd be pretty typical for a show to do that. Like, here's a heroic male. He falls in love and now he has something to fight for. And so we're kind of done with the female character.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when he like barges back in, and in many ways she's more brave than he is, but when he barges back in, takes his family, takes the family sword, you know, that he, you know, he's going to come for the sword, right? Well, he can try.
Right. That was a big moment, right? I mean,
and I also feel like that worked better than him sort of confronting his father at the dinner table.
Yeah, I think because that's a big turn, right? Like the scene of him kind of cowering at the table, it just felt real natural. You're frustrated, but you're not surprised by it. And you're sure. Not even, you know, and as frustrating as it is, you almost don't even blame him. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a trope that could have easily turned into a, no, Dad, what about you? And then, you know, and then it's like, all right, I guess he's all brave now. But he didn't.
I kept waiting for him to shout to the kitchen for a chicken pot pie.
That's right. So instead he decides, like, he shows bravery, and it's sort of like, it's after the fact, but he does have that moment of like clarity, and he's like, well, I'm going to take this and I'm going to be brave. You know, who do you love? You love a sword. And, you know,
I mean, I guess you could say it's sort of, I mean, it is brave. And at the same time, it kind of is true to his cowardly defaults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he's sneaking out in the middle of the night. You know,
he's stealing it, you know, and he says if he could try. And like, I'm sure in his mind, he's like, yeah, and he would totally get it back. But at the same time, he's just kind of like, well, what am I going to do? He's like, I don't really want to leave my family here, and I want to be with my family. So let's all go together. And it's also an interesting element of, I mean, like, Sam's, you know, he's a planner. He's a logical guy. And so this is very spontaneous. And so that's kind of an interesting take. And that's where the courage, I think, comes through, even if it's fueled by other things. I mean, it is, at the end of the day, even though he's sneaking out and taking the sword, there is an element of courage. He's setting himself up for a problem.
This is a very sort of 80s high school movie theme. You know, you've got the wounded kind of weakling who needs to stand up to the bully and get the girl in the end. I mean, that's like every 80s high school movie was built on that premise.
Yeah, it's a little bit of like, what is it? Maybe some Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, and Gilly gets a prom dress. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, so she has that moment where she walks out. Oh, you're beautiful. Oh, I feel so silly.
You should always wear my sister's clothing.
Yeah. You mean the one that your mother laid out for you?
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, as promised, here is part of my conversation with Jason Kabasi from the Podcastica Network. If you're interested in anything that they're doing over there, Jason tells me that he just revamped the website. Podcastica.com, go check that out. Here is Jason Kabasi. Okay, so the guiding motivation for Jamie is, well, I guess you could say it's two. It's like to be the best artist with the sword who ever lived, right? Mm-hmm. But to be devoted, faithful, and in love with Circe, right?
Right.
And in both of those ways, I don't think they ever betrayed his character. So even if he started doing things driven by those motives that made him seem heroic at times, they were still true to the motives of that character.
That's another storyline that I think a lot of people were dissatisfied with, that he went back to Circe, and I thought it was great because, I mean, it's the kind of mistake that people make with Game of Thrones, starting with Ned Stark. You try to plug them into the typical heroic arc, and it felt like, okay, Jaime's overcome his flaws and has become this shining knight. But no, he's a human being who's in love with his person, and that's more important than anything to him, and he stayed true to that in the end, even though we all hate her and wish he'd stayed with Brienne, who's awesome.
If you'd like to hear the full conversation between Jason and I, check out my other podcast, Cocoons of Horror. After my hour-long conversation with Jason, Steve and I discussed this year's roster of Oscar Best Film nominees. And that is all for this week.